This is a WERU news report. In southern West Virginia, local citizens are engaged in a struggle against state and federal agencies and King Coal. They struggle to protect the land they love and to ensure the health and well-being of their communities. Especially since the 1980s, coal companies in southern West Virginia have assaulted the landscape in large-scale surface mining operations, using a mixture of ammonium nitrate and diesel fuel to blast off the tops of the oldest mountains in North America. The exposed coal is extracted, transported by huge machines and trains to Charleston, put on barges, and brought to coal-fired power plants around the U.S. and abroad. The coal leaves the state, as does the money it generates. The poor West Virginia communities are left with polluted wells, respiratory ailments, flash floods, and unnecessary deaths of miners due to unsafe working conditions. Among those who speak out against mountaintop removal coal mining operations in West Virginia are 21-year-old activist Junior Walk of Coal River Mountain Watch and 60-year-old writer and supporter of union miners Denise Jardina. WERU begins its journey through southern West Virginia with Junior Walk, traveling south on Route 3 to the Marsh Fork Elementary School. Across the creek from the Red Brick School is a coal preparation plant, formerly owned by Massey Energy. The company built a 110-foot silo for storing coal less than 300 feet from the school, with plans to build a second silo even closer to the school. The company claimed that because the silo stored washed coal, it presented no health risk to the children. Some parents and grandparents strongly disagreed. School children have reported chronic health problems like asthma, headaches, and diarrhea. Some local residents mounted a campaign to relocate the school, not just because of health concerns for their children and grandchildren, but also because of the impoundment on the mountaintop just behind the coal plant and school, which stores toxic coal waste or slurry. A dam break at the impoundment would threaten the lives of all in the school below. In the campaign for a relocated school, residents delivered pennies and pillowcases to the governor and organized local marches. One activist walked from West Virginia to former Senator Robert Byrd's office in D.C. Money for a new school did not come from the state, but from grassroots fundraising and a significant contribution from the Annenberg Foundation. In December, Junior Walk, the outreach coordinator for Coal River Mountain Watch, and I drove from his office in Whitesville to the Marsh Fork Elementary School. Junior Walk had worked for a couple mining companies and wrote anonymously for the Coal River Mountain Watch newsletter before joining the organization's staff. Light rain was falling as Junior Walk described the changes he's seen in Whitesville and in the Coal River Valley, the dangers to workers at the coal preparation plants, and the school he did his part to relocate. Junior Walk.
Well, when I was a little kid, we had a movie theater, we had a couple of other local businesses, a lot of restaurants and things like that. And now in Whitesville, all there is really is there's a gas station, two funeral homes, a flower shop for the funeral homes, and a car dealership. That's all there is in Whitesville now. And, you know, I've heard stories about, like, the 70s and 80s, you know, before I came around. And this place was apparently very bustling. The way my grandfather says it is there was a bar on every corner. You just get kicked out of one, you walk across the street. there was apparently, you know, two bowling alleys, two movie theaters back in the 70s. When this place, you know, had a lot of people in it. Now, I mean, the last census, Whitesville has, I think, 250 residents. And that's a very sharp decline from what it used to be. It used to be in the thousands of people.
And so what, is it because of the shift to more mountaintop removal, fewer mining jobs that people have moved out of the area?
Fewer jobs and, you know, people are dying from cancer, from what's going on. People are, you know, just realizing they don't want to live in an area that's being polluted, where their family is in danger of losing their lives, and moving out. You know, it's been a migration, outward migration from this area for, you know, the last 20 years, a depopulation of this area. I mean, I think it's very, it's been a very strategic thing for the coal industry to do, is, you know, push all the people out of here so that they can then do what they please without too many people raising a fuss about it.
Has any mining company tried to buy your parents' home?
No. My parents' home is actually right back there. We just passed it. No, we're not in close enough proximity to any active mining to where they'll, you know, try to buy somebody out. You pretty much have to be right up to the site to get bought out. And what usually happens is they go into a place where they know they're going to be actively mining, and they buy out one or two homes to get everybody else excited about the prospect of the coal company buying their house. And then they start the work, and people's property values plummet completely and hit rock bottom. And then they'll go through and offer to buy a couple other people's houses and let the other people sweat it out for a long time until they're ready to, you know, sell for whatever the coal company is willing to offer. Because it's almost, you know, it's hell living under a mountaintop removal site, having to deal with the blasting every single day and the dust and the water coming off of the sites, flooding your house. I mean, any person that isn't from around here, their first reaction is, well, why don't you just move? Get up and move. And number one, you know, people in this area don't have the money to just up and leave. And number two, you know, this is home to them. I mean, a lot of these people, their families have been in this area since, you know, before this place was the United States, you know. And they have a connection to this land, a very deep-rooted connection. Good friend of mine, Larry Gibson, he's been a longtime activist in this area, says that his mother, you know, brought him into this world, but it was this land that gave him life. And that's the way a lot of these people in these mountains feel about it.
So is that a prep plant that we're passing now, or what is
it? Yeah. No, this is, I guess they're calling it Coal River East now. This used to be the Performance Prep Plant, run by Massey. Now it's Alpha. Alpha renamed it. I mean, it's obviously still a very old prep plant that still releases a lot of very bad things into the water. But yeah, this is a prep plant. that's a belt line. I used to walk a belt line, and you see that little track right there beside of it. You get up beside of that and you walk along it to make sure that it's still running, because that's what transports the coal from the mine down to the plant. And yeah, I actually almost had my arm taken off by one of those once, because it's like, it's these massive belts, right, made of like this rubber material on these huge rollers. And there was, one of the rollers was stuck when I was walking the belt line one time, and I had this stick with me. I wouldn't, I was trying to get it unstuck and make it, like, get it to where it was rolling again, and it just kind of sucked that stick in and grabbed my shirt sleeve and about pulled me into it, but I was thankfully tied off to the rail and it didn't pull me in, so that was pretty lucky.
But you've known of other people who've been caught up by the belt?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, that's one of the most common things that happens at a prep plant, is somebody either falls off the belt line or gets sucked into the belt line, and that's bad news either way. It's, you know, you don't usually come back from that.
And we're driving along the Coal River?
Yeah, the Coal River is right to our right over there. This is a little town called Stickney. There used to be actually houses all up and down both sides of this road before I was born. I mean, they've been gone since for a very long time. But from what I understand, there were houses all through here.
Does anyone swim or fish in the Coal River?
Well, they do, but it's not exactly the smartest thing in the world to do. I don't fish in this river anymore. I mean, I still swim in it every once in a while. When I was a kid, I was in this river every day in the summertime. But not anymore, definitely not. I'll swim in it maybe once or twice a year. But I figure it's no worse than what I'm getting with my tap water, so. Yeah.
But in Whitesville, where you're staying, there's municipal water, and that's safer?
Well, there's municipal water. It's not safer. There's a little water plant, a little PSD right there at the end of Whitesville. We passed it coming up the road here. And that gets the water straight out of the river. And normal water plants, especially, you know, normal water plants in small-town rural America, don't have ways to filter out heavy metals, which is what you have to worry about coming off of these sites. That's the things that cause cancer and brain tumors and Alzheimer's and a host of other really bad problems. So that's still in your tap water right there. I mean, in Whitesville, you know, because they take that water straight out of the river.
So that's the silo?
Yep. We can't go onto the property.
So this is one of the now Alpha companies, right?
Right, yeah. This is the Goals Prep plant, now run by Alpha. You can see the slurry dam right back up there. It's you can see the flat part. I don't know if you can see it for the trees, but... Yeah, that's the slurry dam that holds back the 2.5 billion gallons of coal slurry.
And the water rushing down, is that from a stream or is that excess water from the plant?
That's excess water from the plant. I mean, it's raining.
Discharge.
Yeah, it's discharge. It's raining right now, but even if it weren't raining, that would still be coming off in the volume that it is now. That's constantly coming out of that plant.
And discharging directly into the river.
Yeah. I used to actually fish right back behind the school there when I was a kid. There's a nice little hole of water. I don't know if there's any fish alive in it now. But, yeah, I used to eat the fish right out of the river right here. Right there's the discharge. Right there's where I used to fish. It's sort of a scary thought.
Earlier you were talking about some of the Coal River Mountain Watch efforts. Do you do water quality testing? So have you tested to see what creatures can still live in the water here?
I do water quality testing. It's not that kind of water quality testing, though. I mostly test for heavy metals. I have a conductivity meter, which is what I use, and it doesn't even tell you what all's in the water. It just tells you the amount of what all's in the water, which is what the EPA is using on the mountaintop removal permits now. And so that's why we test for that.
Yeah. And my understanding is that conductivity tests are a good test for how pollution might be affecting the aquatic life.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in streams that I've found with a conductivity over like 550, 600, like there, I can't see any sort of fish or minnows or anything. Like even in the summertime, it's like there's nothing. The stream's almost dead. And I've tested some streams in this part of the state that 1500 conductivity.
And when you used to fish here, what would you catch?
Mostly little bluegill and things like that. You know, no carp or anything. I mean there when I was a kid, there was a couple carps in the river, but I never caught any of them.
So anything else I should be noticing as I'm looking out here?
Well, there's this old reclamation job up here. That was an old slate dump, and there were trees growing back on it and everything else. Like, I didn't ever even knew it was a slate dump when I was a kid. It just looked like the side of the mountain. And then the DEP decides that they need to go back and re-reclaim it, which actually translates into get the incidental coal. And so the contractor that was hired by the DEP... went in and completely botched up the job, and now there's black water that comes off of that anytime it rains. Yeah, that's right beside the school as well.
So has the DEP followed up on that?
No. That's a pretty good joke. The DEP doesn't do much of nothing. We pretty much do what their job is supposed to be most of the time. And their main prerogative is granting permits as often as they can. The EPA is the only regulatory agency so far that has given any sort of thought to what's going on here, any sort of thought to the mountaintop removal and the strip mining in this area.
Minutes later, we drove upstream to the construction site for the new school to open in the fall of 2012.
I'm pretty proud to have been a small part in getting this built, you know. I mean, I personally wasn't involved for, you know, the length of the campaign, you know, but over the past 2 years, I helped a little bit, I feel like. The biggest thing that I did was I showed Charlie Annenberg the old school, you know. a couple other people were there as well, but I was there and talked to him about my experiences there and, you know, and about how my sister has asthma from going there and all that.
And how many students will be at this new school?
About 200, which is a pretty decent-sized school for this area.
The school will serve students up and down the Coal River Valley.
I've never felt that this place was valued and still don't feel that it's valued. I feel that there are things that have happened here and are continuing to happen here that would never be allowed to happen anywhere else in this country. And nobody cares. I mean, I cannot believe that mountaintop removal has been going on since the late 1960s and nobody has paid attention. Nobody cares that they're blowing apart mountains. Nobody cares that we just had a major mine disaster and the company just basically got off with a hand slap. This is in 2011. You know, this is still allowed to happen. And there's no outrage. Where's the outrage at my county and all, you know, a number of other counties around it being destroyed?
That was Denise Jardina, novelist, community activist, and Episcopal Church deacon. Jardina spoke with WERU in Charleston about growing up in the coalfields of southern West Virginia and her activism around coal mining. Her family lived in a coal camp, a company-owned town. Her father was the company bookkeeper, and her uncles and grandfather were underground miners. All lived in the same small company-owned houses. The camp was called Black Wolf and was along the Tug Fork Creek in Gary Hollow. Denise Jardina.
Growing up in the coalfields was a mixed bag in those days. On the one hand, as a kid, you know, if you're not directly, you know, affected by something terrible, you're growing up in this wonderful natural wonderland where, you know, we roamed the mountains every day. 365 days a year, ran real free, and saw all the things you can do in nature, and it was a really wonderful place to grow up in that sense. At the same time, my next door neighbor got killed in the mines, and some of my schoolmates' fathers were killed in the mines, and I saw that sort of thing. There used to be a big sign outside near my grade school that listed all the man hours lost to accident in the mine. So when somebody got hurt, they would tot up all the labor hours that had been lost, and it was like a big scoreboard or something, which was always pretty bizarre to have to look at. And the kids I went to school with, this was a time period back in the 50s and 60s when the mines were being mechanized and people were being thrown out of work. And it was also before the war on poverty. So most of the kids I went to school with were, for example, had rotting teeth and because there was no dental care and didn't have enough to eat. And because my dad was management, we had a little more money. And so my mom was constantly giving, she made all my clothes, but then when I outgrew them, she would give them to the local church rummage sale. And so I would see the kids in the lower grades wearing my clothes. And that was just, something you just took for granted. And so it was... it was mixed. It was beautiful. It was a close-knit community. And it was also very poor. And I also grew up knowing the power that the coal companies had because they owned my house. They owned the land that my house sat on. They told us what color we had to paint our house. We couldn't do anything to the house without their permission. And And I remember, I've always been interested in politics, even at a very young age. I used to sit and watch the news when I was like 8 years old. And I always had a sense then of what the political system was like. I know my mother, for example, was a Republican, but she had to register Democrat because in those days the coal companies, you know, controlled the Democratic Party. And so I would read about the Soviet Union in school, and I would say, you know, they didn't own their land, and everybody told them what to do, and how's that different from us? You know, they have one party, and we have one party, and, you know, it's just, I always was aware, even as a little kid growing up, that I was growing up in a place where you really had no control. The only freedom you had was outdoors when you could run the hills, so...
I'm curious what color the coal company told you to paint your house.
Well, first it was white, and when I was about 8 or 9 years old, they made us all paint it yellow with white trim, which it was a really ugly shade of yellow, which I hated, which is one reason I became aware of it, because I'm like, that's the ugliest color in the world. But our house and the coal company store also, they were all, matched houses, matched buildings, so...
And I'm curious, what buildings were in this coal camp? I mean, what could you find there?
My coal camp was smaller. It had been much larger at one point, but many of the houses have been torn down. So all that we had was, we had the company store, which was a large three-story building, wood building, and then there were 9 houses. And as I say, there used to be many more. There was the foundation of a school. There had at one point been a grade school there, but it had also been torn down because as people had left that particular camp for whatever reason. I don't know the history of that coal company, but it had pulled out and the camp was taken over by a larger coal company, but they had torn down most of the houses. So we were about 2 miles from another larger coal camp that had a larger company store, that had a school, that had company churches. The coal companies owned the churches also, and they were painted the same color also. So it was a very matching community. And you could tell the different, you know, which companies owned which town by what color the houses were painted too. For example, Gary was owned by United States Steel, and their coal camps were all gray and white. And we were Page Coal and Coke Company, so we were the yellow and white. So.
And how did the company store operate? Were the prices about the same if you had been able to travel, say, to Charleston to buy things?
The prices were traditionally higher. And I was past the days of scrip. When my parents were younger, the company stores all had, they took scrip, which is fake money. It's basically coal company money. And that's what you were paid in. You weren't paid in United States dollars, and you had to spend it at the company store. By the time I came along, the scrip was gone. And so I think the prices were becoming a little more competitive because people could take their money elsewhere. But it was still interesting because it was the closest store for, you know, 15 miles around. So people still shopped there for convenience. And, of course, I thought because they weren't taking scrip, but they basically took credit from coal miners. And so you didn't, when you came to the cash register, you didn't pay money. You just told them the name of your dad. And so I think we kids all thought, you know, this is where we go get free candy. And I remember, you know, the hard lesson from my mom at one point, you know, you do not do that, even though they let you, because we have to pay for it at the end of the month. That kind of thing. But it was very different.
And did you have a garden, or did the company store sell vegetables that you could eat?
The store didn't really have a good stock of vegetables, and that's still true in the coal fields, and it's a real problem. We did have gardens. It was not one we owned. The company had set apart a piece of bottom land, which is what we call the flat areas close to the streams, and they had set a large field of bottom land beside the river. And it was divided up into sections, and each family had a section. And so, my mom would go down and, you know, take care of the garden, you know, once a day. And often we kids would go with her and help or sit and watch. That was where you got your vegetables. Fortunately, my mom grew up in eastern Kentucky, and she was an old country girl, and she knew well how to grow things. And she also... you know, people, my mom and others would get poke salad. You go up on the hillside and you pick poke, which is what we called wild greens. And put them in a poke, which is what we call it, a paper bag. So we put the poke in a poke and bring it home, and you would saute that up with some bacon fat, and it was really good, actually. And that was also a source of protein. It was kind of, we were kind of like the early foraging movement. I noticed all the fancy chefs in the world now are out foraging for wild greens, and you know, we were doing that a long time ago.
So what did you grow in your garden?
She mostly had corn, potatoes, different kinds of greens. That, you know, she grew wild onions, although she actually more often got them on the hillside too. But tomatoes were a big thing, and you know, still, you know, you can't get good tomatoes now like she used to grow back in her garden. So.
And I'm wondering now in these same areas, if you were to grow vegetables in the ground, if there may be toxins in the ground where you're growing it, so it wouldn't be safe?
I think it's quite possible. There's been so much flooding because of the mountaintop removal, and of course the topsoil has been affected, and the flooding has the, you know, the water now. Even when I was a kid, the water was not safe to drink or even play in. We were not allowed to play in the creek, which is the one area of that, you know, really natural world that would have been fun to play in that we weren't allowed to, because it had so much mine drainage in the water. And we never had floods when I was a kid. I don't remember ever having a flood, but that area has been flooded quite a bit. So I would have questions about that, yeah. I would wonder what's in the soil now.
And the floods began to become more frequent or began to occur after the mountaintop removal coal mining?
Yes, they became much more frequent and much more severe. Whereas it used to be, you know, if the creek did get high, maybe water in the road. You know, now it's just, I haven't lived through one. I live in Charleston now, but you know, when I talk to people or when I watch the news, and you know, people describe, you know, that the water comes up so fast that, you know, they don't even, you know, it's like that people sleep, you know, with somebody staying awake at night when it's really raining heavily because they might have to get out really fast. And, that just never happened before. Never happened before.
I was reading a bit on your website, and one of the things you said, you mentioned the quirky lives of the people who lived in the area. Can you speak to that?
Well, you know, when you grow up in the coal fields, first of all, people are living right on top of each other. I mean, our houses were so close together that you could literally, you know, take two steps and hit the next house. And you had people from all sorts and conditions of life, I guess you could say. There were two families in the coal camp who were management, and I don't think actually my dad or the superintendent who lived there either had a college education, but they had some postgraduate education. And and then you had people with, you know, sixth and seventh grade educations, you know, living there also. And you just were, you know, people would, you know, little, you know, kids would come in our house all the time. It actually drove my mom crazy. But, you know, you know, kids would come in your house, and you'd go to their house, and sometimes people wouldn't even knock, you know. It's just like it's like living in a big college dormitory. And you just see everything, you know. You see, you know, it's not a question of, you know, I'm a little bit amused at later generations where the parents are trying to shield, you know, their kids from different things. And I'm like, that was just not possible in a coal camp. You know, the flip side was that, that's good and bad. And then the other side of it is that there, you know, people were close, although we also fought. And there was violence. I had a gun pointed at me when I was like 10 years old, a kid was beating up, you know, he was throwing rocks at my dog, and so I was starting to beat up on him because he was a little bit littler than me, and so his big brother went in the house and came out and got the shotgun and pointed it at me, at which point my mom came out and said, if you don't put that gun down, I'm going to wrap it around your neck. so that, you know, it was a little bit like the Wild West in that sense. But you know, it was fun for me growing up as a girl because I never related to the little girls who grew up with the sort of sweet peaches and cream kind of, you know, oh, so dainty and nice kind of thing, because there was no such thing when I was growing up. I didn't know, you know, all the girls I grew up with were tomboys. I was a tomboy, and most of the girls were bigger than the boys and could beat the crap out of them. So, And I like that, actually. I value having grown up in that kind of an atmosphere.
This is a WERU news report on the struggle of local residents in southern West Virginia against government agencies and coal extraction companies. They struggle to protect the land they love and to ensure the health and well-being of their communities. Here, Denise Jardina, writer and community activist, describes the fate of miners in the coal camp where she grew up.
One thing you said towards the beginning when we started talking was that your next door neighbor was killed. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, it was actually after we moved away when I was in junior high school, and it was a couple years after we moved away. And we learned about it by reading the newspaper, because we still got the local newspaper from down there. He fell on a conveyor belt and was sucked into a conveyor belt. And, pretty awful way to go. He was fairly young. He was probably in his 30s, because his kids were my age. And so he was probably maybe in his late 30s. Of course, they moved away then. That's what you had to do. If the husband got killed, then the company put you out. So I don't know where they went to, but that's the last we heard of them. A couple of kids I went to grade school with had lost fathers back in the 50s. It's before I can remember, but there had been a large explosion back in the 50s, and they had lost their fathers in that explosion. And those kinds of things were common back in those days. And there was no really... it was a time period when the union was really weak, and the union leadership was in bed with the company, basically. And so that was also... there was no protection in that sense. There wasn't a strong union. And it was the time period when miners were only working one or two days a week. And this is hard for us to imagine this, but, you didn't work 5 days a week. That was actually one of my dad's jobs. He had this slate board, and he would go out and write on it every day, either work tomorrow or no work tomorrow, because the production was so low that they only called the men in to work a couple of days a week, and that's all you got paid. You didn't get paid for the other days, which is one reason the poverty levels were so high. But it's sort of like, what can you do? I mean, a lot of people were leaving at that time, and that's really all you could do was to leave.
And was the production low because of demand?
I think so. I think, the coal has always been a boom and bust cycle. And I think that was just one of those bust cycles back in the early 60s. Because after, World War II was a real high production time period, and it's when the steel industry was booming also, and we were making all these things. And throughout the 30s and 40s, that production was really high. And then after World War II, the bottoms just started falling out, and that continued actually into the 70s when the energy crisis happened back in the early 70s, and that's when coal began to pick up again. So it was really the 50s and 60s were a tough time in the coal industry, not just for the miner, but if you were a businessman, if you owned a coal company, there was a good chance you might lose it, and that happened to quite a few of them went out of business. So,
and at what point did the unions no longer have such a friendly relationship with the coal companies?
Well, the unions were very strong unions back in the 20s, 30s, and actually even before that, in the teens. And then they had a rough spot in the 20s, but then the 30s, really strong. 40s, really strong. This is the heyday of John L. Lewis. But then I think probably because the industry was so weak, I think that was one reason the union became weak also in the 50s and 60s, and it was real easy for – it's sort of like you circle the wagons, and if you're the union, you don't want to rock the boat because, you're already losing jobs. And the leader was very corrupt at that time, a guy named Tony Boyle, who ended up in prison. But and then in the 70s, you had – and again, maybe because the coal industry was picking up, but you had a reform movement in the union. Arnold Miller became the president, and that was a sort of a renaissance in terms of union power, which continued through the 70s into the 80s when Massey Coal Company really just eviscerated the coal industry. So the union power has been a cycle just like coal industry.
And you said that at the time your next-door neighbor had been killed, that you had already moved away from the area. And is that because your father was no longer working for the coal company?
What happened was the coal company at that time, Page Coal and Coke, this always made me angry. They first of all closed our coal camp, but they sold us a house in the neighboring coal camp, and we could actually, they decided they were going to start selling the houses to the miners and to their employees. And so they tore down our coal camp, the smaller one, but they moved us into the other one and sold us the house. This is when I was in the seventh grade. And about 6 months later, they laid off my dad and a bunch of other people. So knowing that, I mean, I think they knew that when they sold him. So here he had this house he had just bought, and they laid him off. And so this was in the middle of the year when I was in seventh grade. And so he came up to the Charleston area, and finally, after about 6 months, he found a job up here with another coal company. And so we moved to Charleston when I was in the eighth grade.
But no longer in a coal camp. You're in the city.
Right, no longer in a coal camp. We basically, his mine was about 30 minutes away, and my mom got a job in Charleston. And so they relocated in between, sort of, and it's just a little area, non-coal camp. We owned our own house and so forth. And I don't think anybody else around us was connected to the coal industry at that point.
So I wondered if we could move a little bit forward. and you've already mentioned Massey, but just to speak to some of your activism around mountaintop removal coal mining, to describe what you have been doing.
Well, first of all, I knew about mountaintop removal when it very first started, because my dad's company was the first company to do mountaintop removal. And I remember him coming home when I was in high school, this was in the late 60s, and talking about, oh, they're going to move the whole town of Montgomery up on top of this mountain where they've got this coal mine, they're going to flatten it, and they're going to move the whole town up there. And I'm like, why would they do that? It's fine where it is. Montgomery is it's like several thousand people in a college. Why would they move this on? Oh, that's what they're going to do. And that's what they told my dad that was happening. And so that was the first one. It's now the site of the state penitentiary. So that's what they ended up putting there, but in most cases they don't put anything there. So I actually early on knew about it and thought it was the most bizarre thing, but really it began expanding in the 70s, and I began to be more aware of it. And so after I was out of college, I began, actually what turned me in an activist direction was the Buffalo Creek flood, which was actually not so much a flood as a dam break, where a coal sludge dam broke and killed 125 people on a Saturday morning, wiped out an entire hollow. And for me, and I think for many people my age in this region, that was as much or more of a turning point as the Vietnam War was for a lot of other people in terms of politics. I mean, I started out a Republican, and I became a Democrat after that. I became a liberal after that, or a radical, and began to be involved after I graduated with a variety of different anti-coal groups, both labor, supporting the UMW. I was involved with several strikes during the 80s and 90s just as a supporter, an outside supporter, and as a journalist, and also then mountaintop removal as it expanded. So environmental issues, was involved with a number of organizations over that. And also, after a really devastating flood in 1977 in southwestern West Virginia, something called the Appalachian Land Ownership was formed. And it was a group of citizens, a number of citizens groups working with, got some funding from the Appalachian Regional Commission and some technical support from Appalachian State University. And we did a region-wide study of land ownership from Pennsylvania all the way, I think it was Pennsylvania, definitely West Virginia, all the way down through to Georgia. And I was in charge of McDowell County, which is where I grew up, that county, in terms of going into the courthouse, totting up who owns the land, what kind of taxes they're paying. And this was something that went on all through the region for a period of a year. And found that in my county, and this was typical of the coal counties, over 80% of the land was owned by outside corporations that were paying almost no property tax. That had happened, between 1870s and the 1880s, that land swap happened so fast that it was kind of like, Native Americans being dispossessed. It was that fast of a thing. And so all of those things came together then, a number of citizens groups who were using the, those that information and tying it to environmental stuff. And also the UMW at that point was also very good on a lot of these issues. And I remember we had a lawsuit in McDowell County that was joint. That was myself and the Catholic. I was the Episcopal deacon there. There was a Catholic priest. There was the West Virginia Education Association. There was the United Mine Workers Local, and there was the NAACP. And we joined together to sue to get land property taxes raised and address land ownership. And so that kind of ferment was going on at that time period in the late 70s and early 80s. And that's when I really began to get more deeply involved. We used to have regular meetings at the Highlander Center, which is the famous, you know, during the Civil Rights Movement where Rosa Parks and others went for civil disobedience training and so forth. And it was a pretty exciting time, actually. And I was involved with the Massey strikes in the 80s and then the Pittston strike in the 90s. And actually the late 80s was the Pittston strike. And I wrote pieces for The Nation and for The Village Voice about the Pittston strike, which was interesting.
What was the outcome of that lawsuit that you and others brought?
It went all the way to the state Supreme Court. It was thrown out on a technicality, and we've never quite figured out. The local county commissioners supported us, they said, and they voted the way we wanted them to vote. Whether they did it in a way that was deliberately sloppy or whether they just didn't know what they were doing, for whatever reason, they did something wrong that they shouldn't have done, and so it got thrown out after about a year. It did put a scare into. I remember sitting in the county courtroom with, you know, that was packed full of guys in suits, and somebody saying to me, oh, "I've never seen this before. This guy came in from Pittsburgh, and that guy came in from D.C. You made all these guys fly into here." So we shook him up a little bit, but obviously, that's about as far as it went.
So it sounds as though you cost some people some money, if nothing else.
We did, actually, and region-wide, actually, there were some efforts. There were some, you know, some of the levels of taxes did raise a bit. You know, they're not anywhere near what they should be, but there were some. I think the mineral taxes went up a little bit, for example.
I'm just guessing here, but I'm thinking that the Education Association perhaps was involved in the suit because of the low taxes.
Right.
The schools don't have enough money.
Right. In fact, what we found was that the coal companies were paying like $16,000 a year to the Board of Education, which wouldn't have even bought a school bus back in those days. You know, so that's definitely why they were involved, and that was true statewide. And there were actually some politicians, including a future governor. Who was one of the leaders of something called the West Virginia Fair Tax Association to try to get to address some of this stuff. So, you know, it was the more liberal politicians, but there were, at that time, there were actually politicians who were supporting us also, which you just don't find that now. There's not anybody now standing up against the coal industry, but at that time there were, you know, there were some significant people who were helping us.
Next, historical novelist and community activist Denise Jardina describes the Massey and Pittston strikes. They had quite different energies.
The Massey strike was incredibly depressing because Massey was very successful, basically breaking the union. I mean, they went after the union mines that they had bought out and laid people off and brought in scabs from outside the region. And it was a very bitter strike because the people who got laid off fought back, but they eventually lost. And you know, West Virginia went from being, you know, a largely union state to being a largely non-union state in a period of, you know, from the 80s through the 90s. And that's been incredibly devastating, not only for the workers, but for the political process again, because the union had been a strong progressive force that wasn't, is not anymore. You know, the Pittston strike, at least for a while, was just the opposite. It was like this mass uprising of this entire county, Dickinson County, West Virginia, that We called it an Appalachian Intifada because it was, you know, the Intifada was, you know, been happening, you know, in Palestine about the same time. I mean, you're talking about gray-haired grannies, you know, sitting in front of coal trucks. You're talking about five-year-old kids sitting in front of coal trucks. You're talking about gas stations that will not put gas in the car of the state police because the state police had descended en masse, you know, to this county. And it was civil disobedience, you know, from the, you know, the county politicians on down. You know, all the preachers are out preaching, and you know, the grocery stores are refusing to sell groceries to the state police and to the, you know, any of the Pittston people, and it was, you know, there were federal marshals in. They started, you know, making arrests right and left, and you know, I spent a week living with a coal miner's family while I was doing the Village Voice piece, and there was a speed minimum. If you had to go above a certain amount of speed, because what people were doing were they were driving in front of coal trucks really slow and slowing down the coal trucks. And so you had to watch, you know, how fast you were driving. You had to drive a certain speed. They arrested a nun who was driving she had a large van that was rigged out as a medical. She went from town to town providing medical care. They arrested her for driving too slow and hauled her off to the federal courthouse. And so people started deliberately driving slow. And I can remember, you know, in my little compact car, you know, you wait and you see a coal truck coming and you pull out in front of it, you know, and then you slow down to 5 miles an hour. You know, and you do that for a while until you know, if you think you're coming to an area where there might be state police, and then you speed up again. You know, that we played that kind of game with them that week. I mean, the other people were doing that all the time. I was actually there several times. I was there for that 1 week while I was doing the story, but I was there a number of other times also. I used to ferry students back and forth from Duke and UNC. I was living in Durham, North Carolina at the time, and there were students active in the strike. I would drive them up there, and they would spend some days up there, and then I would go up and get them again. And, you know, one time when I was staying with this family, there were helicopters that buzzed. They came down over our house one night, you know, sat right down on the house. They just did it to intimidate. They would bring the helicopter right down on top of the house and then pull off again and, you know, do this in the middle of the night just for harassment. It was quite a time. It was like being in a little war zone. And it was totally nonviolent, though, on the part of the miners. At one point, though, they took over the coal mine, a large preparation plant, which is a preparation plant. It's like a huge building, usually, you know, 5-6 stories tall, and took it over and held it for several weeks, actually. And and I went in at one point. They let me in with my press pass, and I got to climb up on the top of it and be up there with them for a while and talk to them. And it was one of the most exciting things I've ever lived through. And the level of commitment, I mean, there were clergy coming in from all over the region and getting arrested, you know, and nuns, and you know, walking down the road and sitting in the middle of the road in front of the coal trucks. And and finally we won. Actually, the bad news is that then several years later the company sold out and closed things down, and now is Alpha. They retooled themselves. First of all, they got out of coal totally, and then they kind of came back in and very quietly started up shop again and bought out Massey. And so now they have all these non-union Massey mines. And, you know, what's going to happen next, I don't know, because it definitely is a different company, but it has that history. That was the same company that was responsible for the Buffalo Creek flood. So those two companies are sort of twined into the history that I know.
So how long did those strikes go on for?
The first one, the Massey strike, was in the early 80s, early to mid-80s, and it went on for a couple of years. And the Pittston strike also went on for a couple of years, and that was in the late 80s, like 89, somewhere around in there.
Nonviolent resistance was key to the broad community involvement in the strike.
You know, the union was, I think, partly inspired by, you know, South Africa and some of the things that were going on elsewhere in the world. was making they really a real effort for this, you know, massive nonviolent civil disobedience. That, and they preached that over and over and over. And I've been to meetings where they, you know, because in the coalfields with our history, you know, there has been a tendency, you know, nonviolence is a fairly new thing. You know, a lot of these guys, you know, they just assume, you know, get out on the hillside with a gun or something, you know, and you know, so that was something new, you know, but that was what was being emphasized, and it really did. For a while, it definitely worked because it got the whole community involved. It wasn't just, you know, this was, I've never seen anything like it. We're talking about Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives. This entire county, from top to bottom, was just in shutdown mode. And I don't remember any, like, dissent or, like, oh, we shouldn't be doing this. You know, this was like, I've never been a part of anything like this before.
And were your parents still alive when your activism began?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And how did they respond to it?
By that time, they were supportive. You know, my parents started out conservative. They were both Republicans, and they kind of made the shift along with me as time went on. Even my dad, who was the coal company guy, but he got kind of screwed over by his company. He was forced to retire early so that they didn't have to pay him as much. And so he kind of learned a hard lesson that just because you don't go underground doesn't mean they don't, you know, treat you badly. And so they were very supportive.
Denise Giardina ran for governor in 2000 as a third-party candidate, in part to raise the Mountaintop removal coal mining issue. She is a fiction writer and is a writer in residence at West Virginia State University.
I love history, so you know, most of my fiction has been set in the past. But I've wrote a two-book fictional history of West Virginia, basically, probably the center of my writing.
One of those books was The Unquiet Earth, a fictional version of the Buffalo Creek Flood and the Pittston Strikes. It covers the period from the 1930s to the 1990s, and is partly based upon her childhood experiences.
And so you've both written fiction and nonfiction for your articles for The Nation and for Village Voice. What draws you to both?
Well, I'm actually much more drawn to fiction, to be honest. I did the nonfiction because I really wanted to get the story out there. And I was, you know, I'm getting old. I think I'm not sure I have the energy to have done that now. For me, fiction, in some ways, it can be more powerful because you draw people into the story.
Another line that I pulled was that you said that you lived in a place that was not often valued. Can you speak about that?
And this is just me. I've never felt that this place was valued and still don't feel that it's valued. I feel that there are things that have happened here and are continuing to happen here that would never be allowed to happen anywhere else in this country. And nobody cares. I mean, I cannot believe that Mountaintop removal has been going on since the late 1960s and nobody has paid attention. Nobody cares that they're blowing apart mountains. Nobody cares that we just had a, you know, a major mine disaster, and the company just basically got off with, you know, with a hand slap. This is in 2011. You know, this is still allowed to happen, and there's no outrage. Where's the outrage at you know, my county and all, you know, a number of other counties around it being destroyed? You know, it's one of the poorest counties in the nation, one of the five poorest counties in the nation. And I can't imagine anywhere in New England, for example. I know there are problems there. I know there are environmental problems there. I know there are corporate ownership problems there. But I cannot imagine any part of New England being treated the way we've been treated. And partly nobody cares because we're just a bunch of ignorant, stupid hillbillies who marry our cousins. Is the way it's always, I mean, even, you know, when you look on the internet, you know, when I sometimes on the internet, I'll see an article in a national publication that'll be a really good article about something that's happening here. For example, the Washington Post a year or so ago did a really excellent article on mountaintop removal. So then on the internet, you know, then you have the comments on the internet. You know, you look at the comments, and they're just horrible. Like, all those poor, ignorant people, if that's why they want to live, let them live that way. You know, they're just a bunch of ignorance, you know, what I mean, just, you know, incest, you know. I mean, it's just all the stereotypes, and I just can't imagine that in any other context. So we're still not valued, I don't think. We're still, subject of fun. We're subject of, horror movies. Let's set a horror movie in West Virginia and have cross-eyed, ignoramuses, go attack teenagers, that kind of, So, yeah, I still feel that that's the case.
And what do you love about this land?
Well, I've always loved the mountains, which is one of the reasons, mountaintop removal, is just like an attack. It's like a rape or something, because this land, the landscape is like embedded in me. And I remember when I was in college, I went and spent a semester in England, and coming back and landing at the airport here in Charleston, and you can see, the hills kind of stretching far away. And I just started crying, because that landscape was just, I don't feel comfortable being out in flat landscapes. This is really embedded in me. And so when it gets attacked, it's just, it's so difficult. And yet it's what keeps me here too, I think. There's almost a perverseness too about, we're treated badly, and sometimes I get so mad at this place, and yet I don't feel comfortable other places because it's almost too comfortable. And at least we're all in it together here. We're in the same boat.
To learn more about the work of Coal River Mountain Watch and the writings of Denise Jardina, visit crmw.net and denisejardina.com. Jardina is Giardina. Thank you for listening. For WERU, I'm Carolyn Coe.